Greetings, everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It's me, Chris Denson, your gracious host, coming at you live from WeWork Studios. If you guys want to get down like me, go to we.co/crush for some amazing things, or just follow me at Densonology, and I'll bless you with some cool stuff. But if you are tuning in for the first time ever, this show covers all things innovation, ideas, creativity, smart people doing smart stuff, even when they just arrived back from Mexico, short of breath this morning. Say hello, Drake Sutton Shearer.
Hey, hey. Nice to meet you all out there in the universe.
That's a lot of syllables in your name.
It is. I'm a Kiwi, and it was a thing back then, and it sucked. And
so that was a baby naming. There were no Jennifers. That's kind of like that was, I came up in the Jennifer era.
Everybody was
Jennifer.
This was a mother and father surname put together.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. That's good shared real estate. Your parents must be nice people.
We like to share some real estate.
They raised a great guy.
You think so? I hope so.
What was, before we get into your stuff, what was your key life lesson you learned from your parents?
Belief.
Ah.
Yeah, we grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere, and we had three TV channels, and we watched a lot of American entertainment and a lot of English entertainment, Faulty Towers and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
But everyone around me was very confined by you can only do this, right? Kind of thing. What's in front of you when you have career day and you're 9 years old, and they say, what do you want to be? And you choose from a police officer, not that's a bad thing, or a fireman or a farmer or whatever. When you say, I don't want to be any of those things, they look at you strange.
Gasp from the from the community.
So I think from my parents, it was just, you know, do whatever you want, be whatever you want, no roles, make them yourself.
And so, because you told me something that echoes that loudly, mm-hmm. which is the fact that you've never had a job per se. You've been an entrepreneur your entire life.
I took a break for a year and a half and worked for a friend of mine to help him do some stuff. But
not a year and a half of work. Yeah. All right, so let's back up a little bit. Let's just give me the 101 mm-hmm. on who Drake is and a little bit about Prohibited, and we'll go from there.
I grew up in New Zealand. I've been on my own since I was 15, building businesses, was in entertainment for many years in the music business. That's where I got my start. I've been lucky to have a few different mentors along the way in different industries. So I've been in the music business. I've been in the technology, social app business. I've been in the music publishing business, talent management business. And I kind of came full circle 5 years ago when I, I'd had a few exits, a couple of losses. I was high school dropout, but I'd incubated a business at Wharton Business School up in San Francisco. So kind of being in and around academia,
not by choice.
Cannabis was happening in the market, and I saw a reason to be involved because I could do good and profit. And I understood it. So I wanted to bring my set of capabilities and build a new business.
Do you need to be a practitioner in order to be an expert?
Loaded question. Good question.
Well, you hinted to it. So
there are a lot of people running cannabis companies who have no idea what the consumer may be interested in, given the products that they're building and selling. Right. So I think, even if they're hiring great people that are skilled, that understand those nuances, they still need a basic understanding. That doesn't mean you have to sit around and smoke weed all day. It just means to understand where the culture is coming from.
Yeah.
Because that's how you understand what consumers are interested in today. 10 years from now, that's not the case, because it'll be an incredibly mainstream product. It'll be across everything from food and beverage and pharmaceuticals.
I think there's a couple of things there. One is just the perception, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the public perception. And we talked about this before, where you've experienced that on the business side. And like people are like, oh, no, we're not touching that. Mm-hmm. But then you mentioned like the medicinal things, or, you know, there's a place where my wife is going to get a facial and they just sent an email like, try our CBD face. You're like, oh, well, maybe I will.
Maybe it's actually CBD. Maybe it's not.
Right. So, so there's this whole, like, I guess, varying levels of perception. Sure. How does that come up in your work, in your day-to-day?
I mean, when we first started raising money 5 years ago, We did about 189 pitches to raise the first $2 million. It was pretty rough.
189?
Yeah, I counted them because I cared. Every pitch was very passionate. We felt we had a great thesis, and we wanted to prove it. And every single person wanted to know everything, right?
Yeah.
It was the most curious, focused pitch cycle of my life. And even when it came down to funding or signing deal docs, people would say, you know, my wife or my lawyer or my job. It was all about reputation risk.
Sure.
And this is 4.5, 5 years ago. Now, you know, everyone's calling saying, how do I get involved? What do you want? Whatever you need. I'm in, right? So it's incredible to see a paradigm shift of not only acceptance from a business perspective, but just socially. Because these are people that are retail investors, you know,
sure.
They're the small checks, you know, and institutionals. They've all got social lives, you know. So now they're talking to their doctor about CBD.
Right.
Or are you familiar with THC? They're out at dinner parties or whatever, and people are smoking or eating edibles or whatever it might be, and it's more socially acceptable. So the conversation's very different.
How do you survive 180? Because it sounds like a lot, which it is a lot, but
it is, yeah.
But there's also like you said, the enthusiasm of the 185th time has to match the first time,
yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
There's I believe personally, speaking of belief, like that there's a, you know, what your self talk yeah. before you go into like all the mechanics might be there, but if in the back of your head you're like, they're gonna say no,
yeah.
They're just going to ask a bunch of questions and then they won't call us. Like,
I mean, I started thinking differently where it was like, well, I dare them to say yes, you know,
nice.
And so I'd go in there with that kind of, you know, mind mechanic. But we really had a belief in what we were doing. And for me, it felt kind of universal, like all things had come to this point in my life where, okay, everything I'm now pitching is everything I've done. It's all my experience. The timing is here and somebody's going to get it. And then it'll start to flow. And it did, you know, and since then we've raised, you know, $12 million and another 10 on the way, but you know, it's, which is still not a lot of money, but it's relatively a lot of money for cannabis.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. So what, I'm going to stick with this 189 thing for a second. What was different from the beginning, from the inception of the idea? As you started getting, and obviously the climate changed a little mm-hmm. bit, but what became different about how you told the story over time?
Great question. You know, telling the story of, well, there's two things. Investors want returns, right? They love passion projects, but if there's no return, they can just throw their money away somewhere else. That's maybe dearer to their heart. I think that there were two stories we were telling. One was an investable opportunity that we weren't 100% sure on what that outcome would be, but come along for the ride and find out. It's either going to be a massive win or a zero. nothing in between. Right?
Exactly.
You know?
No second place.
Right, no second place here. And because, you know, it was first to market and you know, we were leading in what we were looking to achieve. The second thing was focusing on social stigmas. We wanted to change the perception of like the stoner mentality. And although a lot of people still embrace that, and I don't hate on that at all because it's part of culture, we aren't talking about alcoholics who are drinking alcohol
right.
these days in the same way, right? Like this. So, alcoholism is not associated with fandom.
Mm-hmm. True.
You know, it's not celebrated, right?
Yeah.
And yet stoner culture is still somewhat celebrated in different parts. So, which is interesting in itself. Yeah. But I think that a lot of people we were talking to were first entertainment people. Then I, you know, when I met with Donald Glover, who I'm a huge fan of, and he's super creative, obviously, you know, Donald totally got it. He was very focused on us making videos about how to roll a joint, right?
Right,
how,
right, right.
You know, so like, right. It's like, people want simple shit. Let's give them something simple. We're like, you know, we want to do that, but we want to do more. So,
isn't it? Well, that's an interesting perspective from him,
yeah.
which I think he's a complex mind. Right.
Yeah, he is
creatively. Right. But yeah, to say,
yeah,
let's get down to the basics.
Right.
And I think most like I'm the guy that like goes immediately to the wow factor or like, you yeah. know, try to, you know, create that awe inspired moment. But sometimes yeah. it is the brass tacks.
He was really focused on the humanistic side of it. Like, you know, we were talking about okay, sure, vision to achieve and everything else, path to get there. And then, you know, we were like, okay, so what should we create? You know, because we started as a website, as a publisher. You know, and he was just like, you know, people want to learn how to do things the right way. So
yeah,
which is it? Because, you know, there's millions of videos on YouTube.
I bet.
You know, but it's like individuals' perspectives versus an authority perspective.
Yeah. So fast forward to today, kind of just walk us through the growth, because you know, there's so you started off on the content side, but now it's grown into multiple facets.
Yeah, you know, we're smart enough to know that we don't know everything, and so we entered the industry and said, okay, our point of view is content, messaging, and design, which didn't really exist at the time.
Yeah.
Let's build a product.
CMD.
Yeah. Uh-huh. There you go. Funny. You know, and so we did that, and people came to us and said, hey, would you make video for us? And part of the business model was branded content, because it was definitely a trend at the time, 5 years ago. And so we started producing a lot of video content, and we became, you know, the leader in doing that in the space. Then those companies came to us and said, hey, we like what you're doing there. Can you also design our brand? Can you help us develop a product? Can you help us do packaging? And we said, okay, great. Now let's spin up an agency in-house and do that. So then we did about 120 something projects where we helped companies design their brands and packaging and product development, from weed, you know, bud, to oil, to edibles, to all kinds of different products. And so we learned a lot. And then we had a content studio, doing a lot of branded content. And then we kind of looked at that whole thing and said, well, you know, what's happening in cannabis is the first wave was cultivation. The second wave was retail and distribution. The third wave is brand.
Right.
So we were very uniquely positioned last year with this kind of ecosystem of enterprise capabilities that were proven, and a great team, to say, well, let's invert the capabilities and build for ourselves. And so now we're, we've turned this company, Prohibited, into a consumer product brands company and a content company.
How many employees are you, I get so far?
You know, my CEO.
Like, it's just me.
It's just me. I'm a very busy guy. You know, we have just north of 50 across the U.S. and Canada. You know, so it's a very North American focus.
I was just
down in Mexico City for a few days. There's a lot going down there too. So we're looking at that.
Yeah, now that El Chapo's gone, free market.
Unbelievable.
As you were talking about sort of the shifts and the pivots and adapting new skill sets, you know, I think any business goes through those options, right? Like, how did you know what was on mission for you? And like, what was like the critical mass where you're like, okay, one branding assignment is one thing, but then 25, you're like, all right, maybe we should make this a practice.
Yeah. Well, you know, businesses are always searching for a scalable business model, right? That they can invest in, or others can too. And I think that when we opened the agency, we didn't know if it was going to be a cost center or a profit center. We just knew we'd learn a lot.
Mm.
And what better way to learn than someone else paying us to do it?
Yeah.
So we did. We did a lot of great work. We also learned that the entrepreneurs in the cannabis space were in need of a lot of different skill sets that they didn't have. There was also real unrealistic expectations from a lot of people. You know, so I think that it's become more sophisticated now.
Yeah.
I'm starting to see hires from the CPG or the alcohol bev space coming into the industry, and those people are becoming easier to deal with, right? Because they know how to build product and branded businesses.
Do you find that, I'll tell you a little anecdote, but do you find that this ecosystem of entrepreneur is different? Socially, psychologically? I was in Toronto and I got invited to go on a cannabis cruise with a bunch of like founders, investors, and VCs. Yeah. It was the most unorganized. I mean, shout out to those folks because I love them to death. But it was highly, no pun intended, or unorganized, right? Yeah. And you're like, it's like some of this is just indicative of the social activity.
It is. You know, it's funny, man. It's, shit, I want to put my foot in my mouth. You know,
don't worry, we won't edit it out. Just say whatever you have to.
I mean, we're in this business to succeed. If for our investors and our shareholders, and we're in this business because of a personal affinity and a mission for it, right? It's almost like it's the, not since the tech revolution or the industrial revolution has there been an opportunity so big to create generational wealth and also help people.
Right.
It's usually, you know, generational wealth.
absolutely.
Right. But now you're actually helping people live better lives through a multitude of products and infused opportunities. You know, so I think that the entrepreneurs in the space, they're very, very attracted to the cash.
Yeah,
no question.
Of course.
5 years ago, everybody that I met were just focused entirely on advocacy, right? It was just love and peace and hugs all around at the conferences. And now, you know, it's a hyper competitive, people are choosing sides, you know, companies are getting bigger, they're aggregating through acquisitions and additional capital. And so we're starting to see leverage points in the market. And with that comes a mindset, and you need great talent to come and help you continue to defend and build.
Right.
And so I think that we're starting to see an era of more sophisticated business, but there's definitely some outlaws out there, and we salute them.
Well, I think, but you find that, like, you know, I spent some time at a company called Machinima.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah. So, and you know, when you're working with YouTube talent, right. And you, like, you're running a business and they are having fun. I don't want to, you know, understate their work,
sure.
But you know, the business savvy that comes with, you're doing a deal with now with Warner Brothers or mm-hmm. PlayStation, and
very different.
Right. And so you become this intermediary, mm-hmm. and I couple that with, there's a gentleman by the name of Jamin Shively in your world, who's a guest on the show. Mm-hmm. Like a number five guy at Microsoft who left to start a cannabis company. He said the best way to lead a parade is to find one and get in front of it, because your business savvy, I would imagine, is going to serve a bunch of people who may not, like, who are passionate about the industry and right. have a product or an idea or a service or something. And then you go, like, I can help you do, like, how much of that comes into your world?
Well, it's kind of ours to fuck up. Right?
Right.
So it's like we, you know, it's an irreversible trend, right? There's 31 yeah. countries in the world that have a medical cannabis program, some with adult recreational programs. And you just kind of got to get out of the way, massage it, and direct it versus having to create it from scratch. I believe it's $1 trillion+ market globally over the next coming years. And to think like that, I mean, I think coffee is a $30 billion market in the U.S. alone. So, I mean, this is bigger than coffee already.
That's
crazy. We drink a lot of coffee.
Yeah. is this the end game for you? I mean, you say numbers like that, right? And we talk about your history from mm-hmm. the music industry to other tech businesses to now here. Let's pretend your investors aren't listening.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm an entrepreneur. So I think that I've found the industry that I want to stay with. I just love it. I mean, the people are great, the products, the opportunity, the risk.
Yeah.
I like risk. I always find more pleasure and a little pain up front. You know, it's and it's just an incredible opportunity to help.
Hence
people.
The All Black, by the way.
Yeah.
little pain first.
Little pain first, yeah. Thank you. But it's you know, it's just getting started. You know, I feel like I myself and the people in my company are very fortunate because we're helping to lead some others. And so where we are, I believe that some folks in Prohibited 5 years from now will have their own companies that are leading in the space too. So it's hard to pioneer. You got arrows in the front and arrows in the back.
Yeah.
You got to get up and keep going.
Well, I guess along those lines, speaking of, you know, sort of being a leader in multiple definitions of the word, what do you feel like your, let's say you mentioned high school dropout, you know, not really ever had a job except for that one, you know, for 500 days. how's that helped and hurt you?
You know, when you're in your early 20s and you think you know everything, especially these days, I mean, my God, it's amazing how many people in their 20s know everything. not to hate on that, but I'm just saying. And I think it's, if I had to do it all over again, I would find somebody who was incredibly successful, and not just in business, but in life, who I respected. And I would do everything that I could to get in front of that person for them to be my mentor. And I think by doing that, you'll save yourself 5 to 10 years of learning how to go in and around, under and over doors, you know, and other things. And I think that the hard lessons are there to be learned, and you had to learn them. I had to do it. But it would have been great to have somebody, you know, kind of say, hey, by the way, do it this way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but that's just because I like, you know, I like to move fast. Yeah, that I think having a mentor early on definitely helps you to kind of see things differently.
Kind of being rooted in the talent management and music side of it all.
Yeah.
What sort of skill sets do you bring from that practice to your current one?
Dealing with personalities.
Yeah.
Big and small and otherwise. Listening to people and kind of directing traffic.
Dive into that for a second.
You know, in the music business, like it's entertainment at the end of the day. You know, it's like I said to a friend one day, we're at an arena show in Japan, and I said, you know, isn't this incredible what we've produced? And they looked at me and they just said something very profound at the time, which was, you know, the people who all brought tickets here have no understanding of the work that it took for them to even have the opportunity to buy that ticket.
That's deep.
You know, and it's like, and so you think about it, like, you know, the recording the music, the production, the tours, all of the components, modular or otherwise, that go into the chain of events that eventuate in a concert that big.
Right.
Is a lot of work. And people take it for granted, you know? So I think that having the ability to look at, say, an end product years in the future and work backwards into a chain of events that can get us there is something that I learned very early on.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Cause I would admit, to be able to have a systematic view of a product, like of a singular moment.
Yeah.
You know, we're in the middle of producing an event now, and
what's the event?
It's called Gov City. It's going to be taking place at South by Southwest.
Awesome.
So we're bringing together a bunch of federal employees with non-traditional innovators of all sorts.
Cool. Yeah.
But you know, a lot of it is like, oh yeah, like, I mean, we've all been down this road before. Yeah. But it's just kind of like,
we should think of this.
Small of a moment as it is, there's a lot that goes into it. So
I mean, I was just down at Advertising Week in Mexico City, and you know, things are done a little differently in the LATAM marketplace. A little slower in Mexico City, you know, and these guys put on a great production. But I could tell there's, you know, definitely a difference of production speed there as opposed to, say, New York City.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
I worked in Jamaica for a month and I was like, I've never heard soon come as many times in my life. Yeah. Like, no, it's not soon come. It has, it's been 3 hours.
Yesterday. I went yesterday.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that all this stuff is great. I guess when I think about you also as a leader, like what's your superpower? You know, what's the one thing that you do bring to the table from that grid or that 30,000 foot, you know, space, or, you know, your attitude, cool jacket? I don't know.
I just don't really care what people think that much. I mean, you know, I think the thing
you don't say, seemed a little uptight to me.
Yeah. It's funny. I think I'm just not afraid. I'm just pretty much fearless. You know, if somebody says to me, hey, you can't do it, I'm not the guy that's going to go, I'll prove you wrong. That's just the wrong approach. I prefer to wonder why they're saying that, to find a solution to their no. But there's, you know, in this kind of industry, you just have to be fearless. You just can't worry about, you know, that's what I have a general counsel to worry about.
Right.
Those other issues, you know, but you know, like cannabis is a weird space too. You know, it's you got black market. I mean, our mission as a company is to lead cannabis from the black market to the supermarket. And, but you have to deal with the black market to get into the supermarket today. And eventually that'll move over. But, so, you know, what you're kind of living in these parallel universes.
Yeah.
At all times.
That's one of the things that's always kind of perplexed me is like, as the legalization dominoes fall, there's an other side that's losing money, resources, opportunity, and I don't know how much you can or is, you have experienced it, but do those worlds collide in a way that's challenging or where you have to negotiate some things?
Definitely challenging. More education, you know. There's two parts to answer that question. There's the black market survivors who have been activists and given people like me the opportunity to be in business. And so one part you have to respect that. The other part you have to try to help them understand that legal is better than illegal.
Right.
And sometimes you have to give up on that because they do things their way, right? And the other side of it too is that companies that are in the cannabis business now who aren't well-funded, I mean, there's between in North America, there's nearly 400 million people that live in a post-prohibition economy.
Wow.
And there's nearly 100,000 cannabis companies. So that's 100,000 hopes and dreams of aspiring entrepreneurs, people that they hire, right?
Yeah.
And everything else. And so it's a people economy that it's becoming. And I think so there's going to be a lot of people that will go out of business, which means there'll be a lot of distressed assets. And the question then is going to be who's going to pick up those people and those assets. Is it going to be the Procter and Gambles of the world, the Constellation Brands of the world, or is it going to be the public companies in the cannabis space out of Canada with a lot of stock and cash to throw around? Or, you know, is it private equity looking to roll up distressed and emerging brands into one portfolio? I mean, all these things are unknown today.
Right. No, it's a new Wild West.
Yeah.
Along those brand lines, have you experienced any collaborators as like a Pepsi knocking your door and said, hey, we want to go. How do you navigate that, those conversations?
I hired this guy, Craig Binkley, who I met at an investor presentation, funnily enough. I was pitching in New York in an event a year and a half ago now. And this guy comes up to me and says, you know, you build brands, but my friend, he builds branded businesses. And I'm like, sounds like a badass. I'd like to meet your friend. What does he do? And he says he used to run the Diet Coke and Minute Maid business globally. And then he was the CMO at Coca-Cola Mexico. And he's been a consultant for ConAgra and Johnson & Johnson. I'm like, this is my guy. So we got to know each other and found a great understanding of the future. And he joined the company a few months ago. And so he heads up our consumer product brands group. You know, you got to have someone like that.
Absolutely.
Because he, you know, like I said to him, I said, I don't want to build products for the future unless two things can happen. Consumers will buy them and will have live share because they'll bring them into their lives. And number two, large companies will want to buy them because they can easily fit into their systems.
Right.
Because if you build products with manufacturing processes and all these things that are hyper unique, it just means a large company has to buy the hyper unique capabilities to keep producing your product.
Absolutely.
So we want to make it easy.
That's great. And as this expands globally, right, you talk about North America, but then you're in Mexico, like you've got, and it's coming online, I guess, in a lot of places. How are you tracking your vision or your goals alongside like that rollout?
Man, I wish I had time to do it. It's we're not that smart. I think
that's the next guy you need to meet at an investor presentation.
Exactly. Hopefully there's no more investor presentations for a while. I think, the LATAM market will do $10 billion this year in 2019. There's 11 countries that have a legal or decriminalized program. Europe is increasing patient activity 40% month over month, and it's $116 billion euro opportunity in 9 years from now. So I think I'm interested in both of those.
Yeah.
Regions. I'm also interested in the APAC region in Australia Pacific. It's just incredible, man. It's just, you know, every week someone sends me something and says, hey, you know that this country's now, I mean, I this morning I read that St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean.
Yeah. Yep.
They're gonna put together a program, which are a tiny island.
Yeah, that's
beautiful, right? But it's like, okay, everyone's hopping in. So how are we tracking that? I mean, you know, we are a North American focused organization today in terms of boots on the ground.
Right.
Our investors are too. I really like the LATAM opportunity.
Yeah.
I think Colombia is going to be the largest exporter of crude oil, refined oil as well. Yeah. You know, and as an ingredient, if you're a company looking to infuse your products with cannabis as an ingredient, or CBD or hemp extracts, you want as much biomass or volume of finished product as you can get. And yeah. Colombia will be exporting that.
Yeah, that's I guess I was about to say your day to day must be crazy, but I am curious. Like, how do you manage all this stuff? I know you have a team, but what is, like you said, every day a new article or thing may come up, or an opportunity, or somebody's knocking on the door. Like, what's your personal filter on a day to day basis?
Well, shit, man. Yeah, I mean, I live and breathe this. I mean, a lot of people over the years have always said, and they put books out, like, you know, work smarter, not harder. And that may be true for some lucky people. I subscribe to the work ethic of you outwork your competitors. You know, if you're doing 120 hour work week, some people will say you're insane, but I love it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think for me, it's like, as long as that 120 hours is structured, so I've got time to work on alternative projects. I've got time to do my core business.
Yeah.
And I advise different companies. I'm on the board of a few different companies. So, you know, as long as I fit it all in and it's productive,
yeah,
then it's exciting to me. But it's definitely hard.
What's your favorite non-work thing?
Tennis.
Oh.
In a heartbeat.
You did not strike me as a tennis person.
I don't. To a lot of people, they're like, wait, this guy is more like a rugby player.
Exactly.
But I'm just a massive tennis fan. I played very competitively when I was younger, and I play every week. And yeah.
Tennis court in the farm. All right.
Yeah. yeah, grew up on the grass.
So you've traveled, you've seen a lot, you've done a lot. The show is called Innovation Crush. Hope they told you that when you walked in the door.
Yes.
I'm curious as to what's fascinating you. Like, what's your personal innovation crush right now?
Well, I own a bunch of patents in the technology space.
Mm.
I got very heavily into the virtual goods business some years ago.
35 million gifts.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. 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 Virtual gifts.
Not gifts. GIFs.
Yeah. GIFs. We had the first gift app on Facebook, and sold it a year, I think it was a year and a half later. It was it's millions and millions of those really annoying gifts that people love to hate on Facebook, and we did a lot of deals.
Who'd you sell the data to?
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
So I think for me, the patent thing is a real pain in the ass. So I'm always inventing ideas, and a pretty big file of potentials in my home office. And I, you know, some patents take, you know, 3 to 7 years. Crazy. And, you know, it just takes too long. So for me, I'm trying to figure out, is there faster, easier ways to protect your work and then license or sell them? So that's, I know it's a strange answer, but that kind of fascinates
me. Well, it sounds like you're fascinated by your innovation crush, but like the idea of solving a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think there's always a way to do something easier or better. Right.
Right.
I think. But it's really hard to protect the easier or better way. And it's really hard. It's even harder to protect it when it's protected.
Yeah.
It's like, just because you own patents that maybe Facebook or Microsoft are infringing on, doesn't mean that you're going to succeed in getting money out of them by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. You look at the fashion industry, it's almost impossible to protect anything.
It is. It is. And it's funny, man, because, you know, Chris, it's like we're going from this like creation intellectual property movement where the creator and the created thing is the asset,
right,
to this create it now, don't tell anybody, get the money, go to market, and your speed to market time frame is actually the greatest asset to create value.
Yeah. And what capacity, right? Like, you know, going to market with 10 customers versus like, how do we get a million out the gate?
Totally.
Like,
right. Scale.
Like that's
right?
Yeah. Scale fast.
Yeah.
And that's also hard.
Very hard and expensive. I mean, cost per acquisition for audiences just goes up the bigger you get. Because your channels dry up, you got to pay a little more, you know. So, and if, like cannabis, for example, Facebook, we can't buy any ads on Facebook or Google or anywhere like that. Some people get away with them, then they get shut down. But the terms of service won't allow you to promote any, you know, federally illegal substances. Or
was it, is it strategic on your part to even have the content play?
You know, oh, yes.
So like, hey, here's how to roll a joint, brought to you by these guys who make joints.
No, totally. It was very, it was definitely part of the overall model to do that. So, and we don't sell advertising on our digital properties. We built out a over-the-top video network of 17 platform partners too.
Right.
So this, you know, you find ways. It's almost like, hey, we can't do this shit, so we have to create it ourselves. Okay, let's go build it ourselves. That's what we did.
The Rockefeller model.
Yeah, I guess so.
So one last thing on that, as far as like your file cabinet full of ideas, because I don't think this is a very personal question, but I've progressed to that stage. I have a ton of ideas,
awesome.
But like my wife hears them in the middle of the night. I'm like, well, shouldn't somebody open a store that sells? And I'm like, okay. And then I go to sleep. Yeah. Don't even write it down. But I do have, you know, I do have a few things where when the opportunity comes up, I'm like, oh, I've been thinking about that here or something. And I may like even organize partners or a subtle plan around it. But, you know, how do you go from idea to fruition with this file cabinet full of things?
Well, I used to always be a solopreneur. I would want to own everything all the time, and I'm not giving anything away. And I found that to be a really stupid approach. I think that, you know, you share the risk, you share the reward. You're not always going to be right, but if you have enough rights while you're sharing the risk and reward, you're going to do okay. So I think two things. If you're patenting things or you want to create patents, find a lawyer who's a great patent attorney and give him 50% of your business, start a new co and say you're now partners, you're the inventor and he's the guy that's going to file the applications. Because then you know, otherwise it's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Game alert.
You know, so that's one way, but it's like, you know, I've got a couple of founders at Prohibited, and without them, we wouldn't be where we are.
Yeah.
We all had to pick a lane and
who's your favorite co-founder?
No.
But I am curious to like who, like, just kind of walk us through a couple of them. Just, I'm curious as like the profiles or archetypes that you,
it's very, very different. You know, one, Keith Huffman is, you know, he ran the digital business at Sony BMG. He's a more of a quant guy, you know, more of an operator.
Mm-hmm.
Very good with kind of corporate biz dev stuff.
Yeah.
And understands, you know, managing big P&Ls. And then, Josh Otten, my other co-founder, is from the content creator space. He's a hyper kind of creative mindset,
mm-hmm.
right? So he's more than welcome to deal with the talent. and he brings a lot to the table too. I think that, you know, everyone, you know, we kind of can bleed over here and there, you know, but I understand what they do and that's helpful.
Yeah, that's great. Last but not least, complete this phrase for me. Innovation to me is...
Innovation to me is progress.
That's a new one. Progress in what way?
Progress for yourself, progress for your business, progress for people.
Not a Barack Obama poster. So where can people find you, find more about Prohibited or all your other musings?
You can go to Prohibited, no vowels, PROHBTD global.com. Prohibited.com is the consumer facing site. As well, it's more like a youth culture site. Then I'm on LinkedIn. I think it's Drake SS.
Nice.
I think
Drake SS. And this maybe can help me with this one at some point in time. But I have a 13-year-old and a 6-year-old. And like now, if I want to go, well, thank you.
Yeah.
But tough. If I want to go to the Hollywood Bowl to see a show now, then it's legal here. It's like I'm wafted as a family, by weed smoke, and I'm like, I don't need they don't need to experience that now.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if at some point it'll become like cigarettes where you're like, you have to be within a certain distance of building. Or
it's definitely a debate that's happening around the country. People are getting permits for consumption lounges like here in Hollywood and other places. I definitely think it's an issue because as a former tobacco smoker as well, I used to remember when I lived in New York City, it'd be the dead of winter and you'd be looking for a restaurant. Well, they don't allow smoking. You know, this guy pulls up, there's an anecdotal thing, this guy pulls up in a limo outside the restaurant in Manhattan, and he starts charging people $10 to go in his limo while it's snowing and smoke cigarettes. And I'm just thinking to myself, this is insane. I'm in this limo smoking a cigarette that's going to kill me. But going back to your
that's a good solution, right? Like in some way. Yeah.
But he was containing a problem, right?
Right.
So that society didn't have to bear the issue. And I think that cannabis, you know, look, there's many ways to medicate.
Yes, that's true.
It's just that a lot of people are, we're in this era where smoking it has come out of the kind of the bedrooms, if you were, the clubs, now into the open. And I think we'll start to see more and more innovation around productizing the experience.
Right.
That'll be smokeless.
Yeah.
So I think that'll happen. But, and you know, kids should not be exposed.
Well, that's what I'm saying, yeah. It was also almost like a Bluetooth headset. Like there was a period of time where the Bluetooth headsets came out, everybody wore one because it was just like a status thing. It was like, now you can smoke. And you're like, I'm going to just smoke out in public. Watch this. And then it'll kind of dissipate.
Wouldn't it be weird if people were still wearing Bluetooth like constantly?
Yeah, I have one underneath my headset.
So that's kind of weird.
I figured you might judge me for it. Everyone, this has been another installment of Innovation Crush, recorded right here at we.co/crush. And we will talk to you next time.